Well, folks, welcome to another episode of Mighty Tom's Bible Study. I am your host, of course, Mighty Tom, still wiping sleep out of my eyes. And those like little things that get in your eye when you sleep, I don't know what those are, but getting rid of all that stuff, and I'm just happy to be here. Hope you guys are doing good, too. Happy early Thanksgiving for anybody there who's celebrate that sort of thing. I know we have some international listeners, I think, who've written in. Happy day. God bless you guys, and thanks for tuning in. We're going to be looking at John 6 here today, but I just want to take care of one or two quick housekeeping minor items of note. It appears that I have just dropped the ball when it comes to trying to post every week, so I'm going to try to continue to do my best there. I've got a bunch of other Bible studies that I've done for different occasions and different things. So rather than just try and do John 6 every week, I'll probably just start. It's going to get random, folks, like everything else in my life. but that's okay. So let's just jump in here to John chapter 6. We'll just jump right in on the top end there. So in chapter 5, you know, we saw Jesus healing the blind guy. Jesus healing the invalid man there at the waters. Later on, you know, he had some choice words both for the Pharisees, but he also had some words that explained the relationship between Jesus and the Father and all that stuff, as well as the whole interesting idea of who was bearing witness to Jesus. I thought all that stuff was really good. Obviously it is. It's, you know, Jesus speaking. But I did enjoy that. I did enjoy that chapter. So now we're going to see, we're jumping in here to chapter 6, John chapter 6, and we're going to see Jesus here, he's going to feed the 5,000. We're going to see that here. Verse 1. After this, Jesus went away to the other side of the Sea of Galilee, which is the Sea of Tiberias. Now, the Sea of Tiberias, obviously, it's the far side of the Sea of Galilee. As if you've been around biblical stuff, you probably know that. The Sea of Galilee, it's also called the Lake Gennesaret, Lake Kinneret, or the Sea of Tiberias, besides just the Sea of Galilee. Interestingly, it's the largest freshwater lake in Israel, being approximately 53 kilometers, that is 33 miles for all of us who do things in normal measurements, in circumference about 21 kilometers, or 13 miles, long, and 13 kilometers, or 8 miles, wide. So it's 33 by 13 by 8, or rather 33 miles in circumference and 13 miles by 8 miles wide, 13 miles long and 8 miles wide. I don't think I could have said that any more confusingly, but hopefully you guys will look at a map and get a picture. The lake has a total area of 166 kilometers and a maximum depth of approximately 43 meters, which is 141 feet. At 209 meters below sea level, it is the lowest freshwater lake on Earth and the second lowest lake in the world, after, of course, the Dead Sea, which is a saltwater lake. The Tiberias is situated deep in the Jordan Great Rift Valley. The valley caused by the separation of the African and Arabian plates and is fed partly by an underground spring. Although its main source is the River Jordan, which flows through it from north to south and then down to the Dead Sea and all that. Consequently, the area is subject to earthquakes, and even in the past, I guess, there was volcanic activity, which I found interesting. This is evident in the abundant basalt and the other igneous rocks that define the geology of the Galilee region. Historically, the Sea of Galilee lies on a road called the Via Maris, which linked Egypt from the northern Egypt with the northern empires, like the Hasmoneans or rather the Hittites and the Persians and stuff. The Greeks, the Hasmoneans, and Romans founded flourishing towns and settlements on the lake, including Gadara, Hippos, and Tiberias. The first century historian Josephus was so impressed by the area that he wrote, "One may call this place the ambition of nature." And there were a lot of people who really, really thought this place was great. It had a thriving fishing industry at the time, with, you know, sometimes as many as 230-odd boats regularly working the lake. In fact, the fishing in Tiberias was so good that antiquity records that a special preservative-type sauce was developed, and the fish were taken to places far outside its region of influence. And one of the fishes they interestingly get out of the lake, on a cooking note, is tilapia. It's a really tasty fish, and you can usually buy tilapias in stores, although probably not from the Sea of Galilee. If you take the fillet and smother it in honey and then put breadcrumbs on it and grill it and then pan fry it, that's the way to eat tilapia, in my opinion. Now, what's interesting about this is that the text records that Jesus goes away from there after he sort of, you know, gives the Pharisees, you know, kind of a, I don't know, punch to the head, I guess, theologically. But news of this miracle worker, you know, travels really fast, especially when he heals a man, as well known as this invalid guy there at the beginning of chapter 5. And as we will see, they travel quite a distance to see this miracle worker, whom we know as the Savior of the world. Verse 2. And a large crowd was following him because they saw the signs that he was doing that he was doing on the sick. So as we mentioned in the last the commentary in the last verse, the people come out to see him. They come out to see him to heal the sick. Now this could be because there were rumors that the Messiah had come, or it could be that everyone was just bored and going on a trip to see a miracle worker, or many other options. But I guess ultimately, it was probably all of the above. I mean, it was a large crowd after all, so everybody's going to have different motives there. And on this subject, it's interesting to note that the word here for following denotes in some cases a following as a disciple, and that the text records that they were following because they saw the signs he was doing on the sick. So they wanted to see, like, really, the idea really here is that they really did want to see, you know, what kind of miracles that Jesus could throw up there. Let's see, verse 3. Jesus went up on the mountain, and there he sat down with his disciples. Now the Passover, the feast of the Jews, was at hand. So that's verse 3 and 4. Now several interesting things here. First, the Jews were supposed to be in Jerusalem for the Passover, but they're obviously not there. Passover is important for a Jew, obviously. I've heard that there still exists among the ultra-Orthodox Jews that the idea that if you can hold the Passover correctly just once, the entire nation of Israel can hold that Passover once, then the Messiah will come. Yet where are they? They're up on this mountain here. The other interesting thing is that Jesus just totally told off those whom the populace would have considered the most clean, the most religious, and the closest to God. These Pharisees, probably maybe some Sadducees in the audience too. What does it mean to be clean in Jesus' eyes? Well, you know, in Romans chapter 2:29, there's this great piece of scripture. But he is a Jew who is one inwardly, and the circumcision is that which is of the heart, by the Spirit, not by the letter, and his praise is not from men, but from God. Then there's here in Philippians, we are the true circumcision, who worship in the Spirit of God and glory in Jesus Christ and put no confidence in the flesh. Now let's add one more piece to this little brew. In the days of Antipas, the Jews refused to settle in Tiberias. More or less anyway. The presence of a cemetery there rendered the city proper ritually unclean in Mosaic law, Jewish eyes. You're not allowed to touch dead people and dead things. Makes you ritually unclean. Antipas settled predominantly non-Jews there from rural Galilee and other parts of his domains in order to populate his new capital. And Antipas furthermore built a palace on the Acropolis. So here we have the King of Kings telling off those who put their confidence in the flesh, then going off to celebrate this holy Jewish holiday, Passover, in a cemetery in a Roman city that would have made the whole area unclean for the Pharisees. It's unclean because it's Roman, and it's unclean because it has a cemetery. So the whole area is sort of ritually unclean, and here's Jesus going to, he goes here for the Passover. It's interesting to see, he's not going to Jerusalem for the Passover. He's going off into this ritually unclean area. Verse 5. Lifting up his eyes then, and seeing that a large crowd was coming toward him, Jesus said to Philip, "Where are we to buy bread so that these people may eat?" Now this gets into an interesting question about, or an interesting comment about the veracity of the eyewitness testimony of the writer of the book of John. Jesus asks Philip where to buy bread. Now, why did he do that? I'll let you consider it for a second here. Bum, 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 bum. Answer. Because Philip is from this area. We ran over this real briefly, and I may have intentionally not mentioned it in, I think, the first or the second, or maybe the third Mighty Tom's Bible study. Jesus is asking the local here in his group of disciples. John 1, verse 44 asks, or mentions, now Philip was from Bethsaida, the city of Andrew and Peter. Also later in John, so these came to Philip, who was from Bethsaida in Galilee, and asked him, "Sir, we wish to see Jesus." So Philip is from this area. This is one of those interesting consistencies that only someone who is just trying to record history would do. It's something that someone who is telling the truth would record, and not necessarily, something that... It has historical validity to it. Asking Philip would be the way to say that. In verse 6, he said this to test him, for he himself knew what he would do. Now here's an interesting question. We see here that somehow Jesus knows what he's going to do. The cool thing is that this reflects partially on just how Jesus chooses to do his work. Think back to John chapter 2. Notice that these big water pots were brought to him. He brings the miracle juice, but the other people bear the water pots back to the feast. He's making the water into wine. miracle juice. he's bringing the miracles, but the other people are bringing the water pots back to the feast. That's what's going on here a little bit. Jesus calls us to him and lets us participate in his work and in his glory, in his kingdom as a servant, but also sometimes even as, dare I say, even sort of reigning as co-heirs. That's what he's trying to lift us up to be. Jesus knows what he's going to do beforehand, but he just wants to test Philip. But the interesting thing, I think, sometimes the Bible produces more interesting questions than answers. And in this verse 6 here is a little bit like that. For he himself knew what he would do. Now, how did he know that? And, the snide answer with some people is sort of like, well, he's Jesus. He knows everything. Well, not really. There are some things that he doesn't know. And we know that even from Scripture. He doesn't know the day or the hour of the rapture. And, there's a couple other things like that. So, how did he know that? Interesting question. Verse 7. Philip answered him, 200 denarii would not buy enough food would not buy enough bread for each of them to get a little. Now the denarius was first struck about 211 BC during a Roman Republic and at the same time as the Second Punic War, with a weight of 4.5 grams at the time, or about 1/72 of a pound, a Roman pound. It remained at this weight for a while and then decreased to about 3.9 grams. And it then remained at almost this weight until the time of Nero, when it was reduced to 1/96 of a pound, or 3.4 grams. Now this whole thing is just, it's interesting because that's kind of the same thing that's going on. That's kind of the same thing that's going on here. You know, they're debasing the currency, coin clipping, you know. Some other interesting tidbits. When the Arabs invaded later and overtook previously Roman lands, they introduced their own dinar, which is where the name comes from even today. Also, we see the abbreviation of the British penny up until 1971 is a little D. Now, from a practical standpoint, the problem Philip is answering is twofold. We don't have the money, and even if we did, we wouldn't be able to really feed them. This reminds me a lot of the miracles we've seen up until now. You know, I kind of hammered the point home in John, I guess, two MTBSs ago. Jesus has over and over shown that he walks outside of the people's expectations of the moment and uses that to point back to himself. In this case, the likely thing that people were thinking might have been manna from heaven via Exodus, or maybe they would have that he would magically pull money out of a bag, or someone would show up carrying a lot of bread or something. I don't know. But instead, Jesus feeds everyone from a couple of fish and five loaves, as we'll see here in the next couple of verses. It's very interesting, you know, it sort of points back to that idea of him stepping outside of the miracle. Verse 8. One of his disciples, Andrew, Simon Peter's brother, said to him, "There is a boy here who has five barley loaves and two fish, but what are they for so many?" So Jesus' miracle here begins to take shape. This young boy has the loaves of barley, which may have been somewhat emblematic of God's hand in the Old Testament, especially with Gideon. Let's see, in Judges here, we've got Judges chapter 7, verse 13 and 14. "And when Gideon was come, behold, there was a man who told a dream unto his fellow, and said, Behold, I dreamed a dream. And lo, a cake of barley bread tumbled into the host of Midian, and came unto a tent, and smote it that it fell, and overturned it that the tent lay along. And his fellow answered and said, This is nothing else save the word of Gideon, save the sword of Gideon, the son of Joash, a man of Israel, for into his hand hath God delivered Midian and all the host." Also, it looked as a real sort of peasant food in this time. Everyone is thinking in terms of what can be bought, and here is God. Here God is going to use these peasant loaves to feed everyone in attendance. It's interesting that, Andrew and Philip sort of see this limiting thing, but Jesus has already, you know, foreseen this miracle. See, verse 10. "Have the people sit down. Now there was much grass in place, so the men sat down, about 5,000 in number." So I can't help but think of Psalm 23 here. "He makes me to lie down in green pastures, and he restoreth my soul." Jesus is getting these people to lie down in green pastures. I mean, or at least sit down. The people who came to him for whatever reason, they've come here to meet this miracle man who some may have whispered was indeed the Messiah. And Mark records a similar passage in his gospel as well. Mark 6, verse 39, "And then he commanded them to all sit down in groups on the green grass." This is interesting too, this parallel passage in Mark, because it gives us a clue as to what time and everything, what was going on there, even though we know that it was near the Passover. You know, we even know that the grass was green, which is cool. Verse 11 and 12, Jesus then took the loaves, and when he had given thanks, he distributed them to those who were seated. So also the fish, as much as they wanted. And when they had eaten their fill, he told his disciples, "Gather up the leftover fragments, that nothing may be lost." So we have Jesus feeding the people from the meager dealings of the young lad. Yet it is food from the Lord. You know, we have this picture of Jesus giving the people bread and fish, inasmuch as he really is the bread of life. Romans 14, verse 6 records, "The one who observes the day observes it in honor of the Lord. The one who eats, eats in honor of the Lord, since he gives thanks to the Lord, while the one who abstains in honor of the Lord and gives thanks to God." So that's kind of cool, you know. Here we have, he took the loaves, and when he had given thanks, he distributed them to those who were seated, and so the fish as well. And when they had eaten their fill, he told his disciples to gather up the leftovers and fragments that nothing may be lost. So he's feeding everybody as much as they wanted, you know, from this, you know, food from the Lord. Verse 13. "So they gathered them up and filled 12 baskets with fragments from the 5 barley loaves left by those who had eaten." So here's an important practical point to following Jesus. He always provides for you. If you're in his will and going the way he wants you to go, he'll provide for you. And even most times there's a bit left over for him. For you rather, not him. Like he's always got plenty to eat because he's the provider, you know. But yeah, he will provide for you, you know. See, verse 14. "When the people saw the sign that he had done, they said, 'This is indeed the prophet who has come into the world.'" Now, it's funny that they sense that Jesus has something supernatural going on with him, but they miss what he really is. You know, that is the Son of God, the Messiah. This echoes the Samaritan woman, who we had already studied there in chapter 4, you know. John chapter 4, verse 19 mentions that the woman said to him, "Sir, I perceive that you are a prophet." And this also echoes into the next chapter, that is chapter 7. John 7, verse 40. "When they heard these words, some of the people said, 'This really is the prophet.'" Now all this profit-taking, okay, that's a bad pun, through the Gospels may very well have something to do with Moses' prediction. "The Lord your God will raise up for you a prophet like me from your midst, from your brethren. Him you shall hear." Now the last quote particularly may tell us something about why they thought he was a prophet. Moses provided bread in the wilderness. So, okay, it was really God providing bread, but you know what I mean. Now, one of the interesting things about the Galilee area at this time is that it was a very sort of, I don't know, bohemian area and had a cultural bent of being an area where revolutionary sentiment fermented very heavily. So this idea of a prophet jives with what we're going to see here in the very next verse. Verse 15. "Perceiving then that they were about to come and take him by force to make him king, Jesus withdrew again unto the mountain by himself." Now there, they see that God is with Jesus, so they believe that he should be king. This gets into their whole mindset of believing that the promised coming deliverer would be a king. They just missed the part about him being a king of sort of like a hidden kingdom. As we have seen, this was not the first time the Jews made this mistake. Now Jesus is unwilling to advance his kingdom in this way, so he goes up onto the mountain by himself. Now this really illustrates an important point about what we as believers can do when others have motives different from ours. Instead of running them down, we can separate ourselves from them or move away from them and distance ourselves. This is in This is in completely keeping with the nonviolent ways of Christ. The other thing was, is, you know, they're making him king. They want to make him king, and, you know, that's, of course, a political title. And to that end, the crowd ends up being willing to support Jesus because they want him to throw off the yoke of the Roman oppression. This is not necessarily, you know, it ends up being almost for their own, to their own ends, you might say. Verse 16. When evening came, his disciples went down to the sea. Okay, so obviously the sea here is the Sea of Galilee. And I guess to be honest, if you've ever looked at the sea here, it really doesn't look like a sea. It looks more like, you know, it's about as menacing as Lake Tahoe. But I guess there are some storm systems that can get caught in the bowl-like topography there and become quite powerful there in that area. I've never been to Israel, and I've definitely never seen anything like that. But I've read this from numerous commentators, so I thought I would include it, and you guys can throw it out or take it, you know, however you want. Verse 17, got into a boat and started across the Sea of Capernaum. It was now dark, and Jesus had not yet come to them. So these guys are fishermen and had grown up on this lake. It seems odd that they would leave out into the lake at night, likely suspecting that a storm was coming. Now, if we were to take the time when Jesus awakened and rebuked the storm as in the first boat ride there, the second one is interesting in that the first one, Jesus actively was there with them. The second time he was looking out for them on afar. This creates sort of an interesting parallel with how God works in our lives. Oh, and by the way, this is the first, we haven't looked at the, you know, Jesus didn't rebuke the storm, you know. In one of the other Gospels, they ride across the boat and Jesus rebukes the storm. And now we've got this second boat ride, which isn't recorded in John. Man, I can't believe I didn't make that more clear. Sorry, folks. So let's do that again. He got into this boat and he started across the Sea of Capernaum. Now it was dark and Jesus had not yet come to them. So all this stuff, like I said, you're fishermen. In a parallel Bible account, there's a first, he goes across the lake, you know, the first time and rebukes a storm. Now he's not with him. But he's going to, as we're going to see, next week, he comes to them on the water, you know, sort of implying that Jesus is always looking out for us. So there. We're going to leave it right there at verse 17. And, yeah. All right, folks. Well, it was good to have you all here with us. You know, I do have a new email, by the way, set up. It is tombionic@rocketmail.com if you want to get a hold of me. Also, there's a little board there on World of Prophecy that discusses the Mighty Tom Bible Studies. There's audio Bible studies there if you want to go and take a look at it and check it out. All that stuff is there. So with all that stuff, I will just say ciao.